Good afternoon, everyone. Welcome to the Human Services Finance Committee. I call this meeting to order. Members, we have a quorum present. We will begin with the approval for minutes for March 21, 2023. Vice Chair Barnett, do you want to move the approval for minutes?
Yes, Mr. Chair. I would be happy to move the approval of the minutes for March 21st, 2023.
Vice Chair Barnett moves the approval for minutes for March 21, 2023. Discussion. Hearing none, all those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? The motion prevails. The minutes for March 21, 2023 are now approved. Members, we have a few bills today, and the first bill on the agenda is House File 1596. Hopefully, Representative Ryan is around.
I think she's approaching, Mr. Chair.
We'll start with Representative Edelson's bill.
Okay, I'm here. Congratulations.
That is House File 1298. I move House File 1298 to be laid over for possible inclusion. And I see you've got A2 amendment. Did you want to move the A2 amendment?
Yes. Mr. Chair, I do not want to move that. No, I don't want to move it.
You don't want to move it?
No, thank you. Sorry, this was before, just the shifting of things in the committee. So, yes, I'm gonna not offer that A2 amendment.
Appreciate it. So, Representative Edelson, please go ahead and explain your bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. I walked in apparently just at the right time. In 2020, 99,000 Minnesotans were living with Alzheimer's disease or another form of dementia. This number is expected to increase by 2025. The challenges facing long-term care workforce is well documented, and the legislature must take immediate action to address this crisis. The bill before you does two important things. It increases the maximum funding for essential community support recipients can receive from $400 to $600 per month, expands the eligible services that the essential community service benefit can pay for to include respite care and companion services. It also appropriates base funding for a respite care grant program for older adults and people with dementia. This previously was funded through ARPA funds one time. Our long care system is already in crisis. We cannot afford to lose our unpaid caregivers and put even more pressure on an overwhelmed elder care system. For those of you who are not familiar, the respite care services are really a lifeline for caregivers that have a loved one that is suffering with Alzheimer's. My mother-in-law, my father-in-law, who has since passed, had Alzheimer's, and I mean, it was just such an amazing program for her. And so with that, I will go to my testifier.
Welcome to the committee. Please introduce yourself for the record and proceed.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Sam Smith, and I'm here on behalf of the Alzheimer's Association. Unfortunately, Tuesday was unable to join us, and so I will be reading a brief portion of her testimony. And Volunteers of America in Minnesota is a nonprofit health and human services organization committed to serving people in need, strengthening families, and building communities. The culturally responsive caregiver support and dementia service has historically focused on supporting African American and East African community members through education relating to dementia, offering memory screens, and supporting caregivers. The stress, health impacts, and costs associated with the long journey of caring for someone impacted by dementia often creates two or more people who are in desperate need of support. Our work, supporting caregivers, reveals the importance and impact of offering respite to caregivers. And this is, I'm working with a caregiver who I will call Doris for confidentiality. Doris is 79 years old and caring for her husband, who is 81 years old, who was diagnosed with Alzheimer's disease 8 years ago. Doris's husband relies on her for his daily living and personal hygiene needs. Doris has recently been diagnosed with hypertension and must go to the doctor to regulate her high blood pressure medication. Doris contacted our program and is seeking financial support so she can go to her doctor's appointment and have respite for her loved one with dementia. It is sad that Doris must decide whether to stay home with her husband or go to the doctor to address her health concerns because she does not have the financial means to pay for respite care services and is not eligible for public support. Our program does not presently have funding for respite. However, we are adding Doris to our volunteer respite waiting list. Thank you, Mr. Chair, and I'm happy to answer any questions.
Thank you so much, Mr. Smith, for the testimony. Also reading the testimony of the, I think you said Ms. Glover, correct? Anyone else in the public who wants to testify on this bill? Seeing none, member discussions, Representative Gilman.
Thank you, Chair, and thank you for bringing this bill. I also have family members that have suffered from this horrible disease. It's tragic. So currently, are there any other programs that offer these things that fill this need right now? Are there things happening right now that fill this need?
Mr. Smith.
Mr. Chair, Representative Gilman, thank you for the question. Well, respite care services are available both on the private pay market and through our home and community-based services waiver system. For many people, they are simply not accessible because they are typically not financially eligible for Medicaid, but don't have the resources to effectively be able to fund respite care services. I would additionally say that, well, I think there's a need for respite across the board, as we heard from Tuesday's story. We also know that in rural communities, the need for respite care is particularly acute.
Thanks.
Any further discussions?
Thank you, Chair Norrie, and thank you, Representative Edelson. I appreciate this bill. I mean, I spent my life caring for seniors in multiple settings, so I realize the need. I wondered if there's any, is this a statewide funding where then it just gets allocated, or is there a method to how we distribute the money as far as in the metro seven county area or versus greater Minnesota for the rural? The reason I ask that is because the resources in greater Minnesota are so limited. Mm-hmm. And so with transportation, there's just a whole variety mm-hmm. of things. And I know the need is statewide, but I wondered your thoughts on how you see this being distributed.
Mr. Chair, Representative Zalesnikar, thanks for the question again. The statute is silent on the exact criteria that DHS would set up for the RFP they would put out for the grant program, but I would hope and expect that it focused on balancing support for both rural and urban communities that are facing shortages of respite care. Thank you.
Thank you, Chair Norrie. Thank you, Representative Edelson, and thank you for your testimony. I would just encourage if there's any opportunity to consider that, because the magnitude, the options for people in rural Minnesota is just limited by proximity, and there's many spouses caregiving solely on their own that I know providers get calls every day asking for some relief if there's any beds. And mm-hmm. and so having those abilities for them to get a break, to run to a doctor appointment, have those opportunities, they don't have other programs or centers or that large communities would offer. It's just not available, and it hasn't been in the 30 years I've been doing this. So mm-hmm. I hope you'll seriously look at that for families that are outstate. Mm-hmm. Thank you.
Any other body?
Just a quick question or quick comment. Thank you for bringing this bill here. This is so important because of, you know, just preventing burnout, because caring for someone who's in a state and you're the constant provider, that's one thing. And then the other thing, too, is by having a respite, it saves the other really expensive option. So thank you for bringing this important bill here. Thank you.
With that, your closing remarks, Representative Edelson.
I hope it makes it for possible inclusion. Thank you.
Thank you. I renew my motion that House File 1298 to be laid over for possible inclusion. The bill is laid over. The next bill is, we're going back to House File 1596. Representative Ryer, please move the bill and proceed with your testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. I'm glad to have the opportunity to present House File 1596, which takes the next step toward implementing the PACE program for seniors in Minnesota. The Program for All-Inclusive Care for the Elderly, or PACE, is an innovative program that allows people starting age 55, most of whom are dually eligible for Medicaid and Medicare, to receive comprehensive medical and social services while still living in the community. Although all PACE participants are eligible for nursing home care, 95% continue to live at home. PACE programs coordinate and provide all needed preventive, primary, acute, and long-term care services so older individuals can continue living in the community. Through PACE, healthcare systems come together to serve the unique needs of each individual in a way that makes sense to elderly people with complex needs, their informal caregivers, healthcare providers, and policymakers. Research has shown that PACE saves taxpayer dollars through a lower cost model of care that has proven effective in preventing hospitalizations and rehospitalizations and helps to support and improve family caregiving. As we look for ways to smooth transitions to and from hospitals, to alleviate discharge delays and address social determinants for patients, PACE has an opportunity to be one of our upstream solutions. In particular, PACE has been proven to support underserved communities with high-quality, flexible care, culturally competent care in the person's home. For those of you who serve on the policy committee, you may recall testimony from Dr. Joe Gogler, who is the Robert Kane Endowed Chair at the University of Minnesota School of Public Health and the director of the university's Center on Aging. He couldn't be here today, but would say if he could, that Minnesota is known to be an innovator and a leader in healthcare delivery, and it's beyond time for us to have PACE. Now, Minnesota has had enabling language and statute for some time now. This bill would direct DHS to conduct a required actuarial rate study and propose an implementation plan, which is a critical step toward program implementation. In your packets, you should see letters of support from organizations, including the Alzheimer's Association, Leadership Council on Aging, and several provider organizations. Now, I'd now like to turn it over to my testifier, Wayne Olson from Presbyterian Homes, to provide additional information. Thank you.
Mr. Olson, welcome to the committee. Please introduce yourself for the record and proceed.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and committee members. My name is Wayne Olson. I work with Presbyterian Homes and Services in Minnesota, and I am here in support of House File 1596. Often our seniors have in the past relied on family, churches, and fraternal organizations for help and support as they age to maintain their ability to live at home. All these supports are not as robust as they were in the past. PACE services are expansive, providing mostly located in a central building at a day center that includes full medical clinic services, bathing facilities, nutritional services, social integration, physical therapies, social work, home health care services, and a full transportation network. In PACE, these services are organized and coordinated as a provider-sponsored hub, with some services being supplemented by partnering with existing community services. Typically, a senior visits the senior center 2 to 3 times per week. Generally, PACE programs use about 50% of the FTEs that a nursing home uses. And as we wrestle with labor and demographic challenges, this is worth noting. The funding for the program is a combination of Medicare and state Medicaid dollars. The rate study that we are requesting funding for identifies service costs that would be expected to be paid by the state at the county level for the population that PACE would serve. The key to success of PACE is the alignment of incentives. For elders who want to remain living in the community, the state saves money in an escalating labor cost environment. A provider sponsor who focuses on wellness and preventative care to avoid expensive hospitalizations or preventable long-term nursing home placement, as there are often needs for hospital stays and procedures, though, and often some nursing home stays, the sponsor has full obligation for those services, all working together to provide independence for a senior as long as possible in the community. In my career, I was responsible to and started and operated three PACE programs in other states. I personally built a PACE program in another state that was successful in helping an elderly woman recover in the community and avoid long-term nursing home placement after being the victim of gun violence. A PACE provider in California is using this model to support among community of seniors by providing culturally appropriate health care, accommodating five different languages, and coordinating culturally informed meals and activities. These are just two of dozens and dozens of examples of PACE's value. Based on the experience in other states, we could expect up to 5,000 people would initially be eligible and benefit from a PACE program in Minnesota. While that may not seem like a lot of people for a state our size, it's precisely how to build programs with health equity in mind. Our current systems are not serving all our state's elders as well as they could be. And we should be asking ourselves if a program like PACE, which could be designed to prioritize culturally informed care and support practices, is worth pursuing. PACE is a tested solution that Minnesota needs to pursue. It is time. Thank you for your time this afternoon.
Thank you, Mr. Olson, for your testimony. Do we have anyone else in the public who wants to testify on this bill? Seeing none, member discussions. Mr. Olson, one question. How many states have adopted the PACE?
30 states.
That is. Representative Wright, looks like the committee, you know, really likes the PACE program. So with your closing remarks and also the motion.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I like your interpretation that everyone really likes the PACE program, and I thank you for your support. And, of course, come find me if you have any questions later.
Representative Ryan renews her motion that House File 1596 to be laid over. The bill is laid over. Thank you so much for presenting the bill. The next bill is 1494.
Chair. Vice Chair Frederick.
I was looking around to see where Vice Chair Frederick was.
Hello.
Sitting, so I'm
kind of hiding with this on today.
Welcome to the committee. I will move that House File 1494 to be laid over for possible inclusion. Please proceed to introduce your bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and committee. House File 1494. As I said in the policy committee, it's a pretty personal bill for me. It is one that is seeking to address safety concerns within the human services fields. I'm going to start this similar to the same way that I started when I presented the bill in Human Services Policy Committee, which is by saying that the overwhelming majority of people who are receiving services in the human services fields are wonderful, peaceful people who deserve every piece of support that they are receiving. However, there are across the board in the human services space places where workers are getting injured on the job. In my line of work outside of the legislature, I've worked at the security hospital in St. Peter for about 18 years now as a direct care staff. In that line of work, I have been punched, I have been tackled, I have had every, and I mean every, bodily fluid thrown at me. On the very unit that I work on, there has been a murder. I've had coworkers simply by doing the rounds that we had to do on the units just to try to, you know, keep our pulse on how things are going, get jumped from a corner requiring spinal surgery. I've had a coworker who, as part of an observation of one of the patients that we had, walked too close to a brick wall and had her, a patient, slam her head against the brick wall repeatedly. Staff were immediately there to respond, but it didn't prevent the injury from happening, to which she had multiple grand mal seizures and is disabled to this day. I could go on with the assaults that I have seen. And unfortunately, across the human services space, assaults do happen. They range from murders in workplaces other than mine, sexual assaults, physical assaults, and we need to do what we can as a legislative body to recognize that these happen. And the goal of this legislation then is to establish a $10 million grant program to allow different human services fields to do what they can to prevent these assaults. And that's what this goal seeks to do. Now, part of the grant program, you can do it from the preventative side. It would allow agencies, whoever, to apply for some of this grant money to do de-escalation training, do what we can to prevent any sort of assault from taking place. You can apply for this grant money to try to make physical infrastructure upgrades to do things related to safety, but you can also do things after the fact related to if someone needs some therapy, if something bad happens as well. Some of the discussion at this, on the first stop in the policy committee was, how do we decide who gets this grant money? And there is not a good answer for that. It doesn't exist as far as I can tell. Because you could say this one facility, wherever it happens to be, had a really bad assault and they need grant money. And I can't say that they're wrong. But I could say that this other facility had 30 assaults, but to a much lesser degree. Who do you pick in that case? Do you pick the one that has a very severe assault, or do you pick the one that has more of the small, you know, minor level, whatever they happen to be? So I don't think that a good way to delineate between this one is worthy and this one is not. And so it is set up to be kind of a first-come, first-served basis, honestly, because we couldn't figure out a better way for it to go. And so if anyone in this committee has ideas on that, I am all ears. But there was lots of people who were part of this discussion that couldn't come to one. The other one that I'm going to try to address before we get to the questions is DHS, as of this bill is written, is the one who will be administering the grant program. They will not be eligible for these grants. County units, tribal units, private industry partners are the ones that this grant program is targeted to. And I think that was the majority of the conversation that we had in committee. But I just want to stress again, the overwhelming majority of Minnesotans who have fall somewhere on that mental health receiving services in some way, shape, or form are wonderful people, not a threat, not violent at all. But it is important, and why I'm carrying this legislation is to say, they do happen. Assaults in the workplaces do happen, and we need to say we see those workers too, and that we need to do something to try to make it so they can all go home at the end of their shifts as well.
Thank you so much. You have a testifier ready to go, so welcome to the committee. Please identify yourself for the record and proceed.
Thank you, Chair Nora, members of the committee. My name is Michelle Saint-Cartier, and I'm the Director of Policy and Advocacy with Minnesota Social Service Association. MSSA is an organization of over 4,000 professionals from across the state who work in all areas of human services. I'm here today to urge you to support House File 1494, which would establish a grant to help ensure health and human services provider safety. I have a background in human services, hold a master's in social work and public health, and have worked in direct practice. Now, like many of you, I work in an office. I have assurance I'll be safe at work. I've never faced any threat to my physical safety, and even when faced with some of the very interesting situations we all encounter at the Capitol, I don't face any significant threats to my psychological safety either. This isn't the case for many human services providers. Many don't have assurance that they'll be safe at work. When they advocate for their safety, they're told they're exaggerating, bad at their jobs, or sometimes even told that they're bad people. The reality is, unsafe situations in human services exist and won't go away by ignoring them. We've heard it loud and clear. This is a problem and it needs to be addressed now. Many MSSA members have bravely shared their experiences with us, including multiple members who were sexually harassed, a member who had a proposed date of death written on a billboard in the middle of town, a member who had major damage done to their vehicle, a member who was threatened with a gun, more than one story of a homicide in a facility where clients lived and providers worked, multiple members who were stalked, and many members who didn't have the training they needed to de-escalate a dangerous situation. Our agencies are desperately trying their best, but are under-resourced and understaffed. House File 1494 would authorize DHS to award grants to human services organizations to invest in workplace safety measures. Grants would be used to pay for safety training, safety equipment, facility safety improvements, counseling if an incident does occur, and systems to track, monitor, and prevent safety incidents. We're proud that MSSA is leading this conversation about workplace safety. It's not an easy conversation to start or to have. The fact of the matter is, when we make the decision to ignore workplace safety for human services, we send a very clear message about who we value. We're in the midst of a workforce crisis that's projected to get worse. Human services providers will be needed more than ever, and they're not going to tolerate working in positions that don't tolerate or don't ensure their basic human rights. I urge you to pass this bill and show our professionals that we value them. Thank you so much, Mr. Chair and members of the committee.
Thank you so much for your testimony. Just wanted to ask if there's anyone else in the public who wants to testify on this bill. Seeing none, member discussions. Representative Lesnicka.
Thank you, Chair Noren, and thank you, Representative, and to the testifier. This is a real quandary for healthcare. And I say that having cared for people that are seniors and have behaviors and are unpredictable and have disease diagnoses, that is what brings us to the setting, brings that person to the setting. And so we're in this constant balancing act of protecting our employees. And then, you know, as the data shows, in the time that I started as a CNA in the 80s, we didn't have falls. We didn't have the workplace violence because we had residents that, if they were mobile and they were going to fall or fracture, they were restrained. And then we had medications that were used. We've moved away from all that, and that's just the fact. And so now we are in a situation where everybody's mobile. We have the least amount of staff in society. And we also have not changed Parkinson's, dementia, any of the other schizophrenia, any of these other diseases. And so in that lane in itself, we have the issues of unpredictability, complete unpredictability. And so I don't think there's a setting in the state that doesn't want to have everybody be safe. And that's the challenge we're working with continually, you know, with whether, and the equipment's a great thing, but I think it's going to come down to, in the correction centers and all those other things, my concern is it's that we're dealing with a cart here and not the horse. We need to fund these settings to allow to have enough staff and to bring respect back to the fields, whether it's corrections, police, long-term care. This is a Band-Aid on a cause and effect scale that concerns me, having been a healthcare worker my entire career. And so we are dealing with really challenging issues and balancing rights of everybody, rights of employees, and rights of people who are not balanced, whether it's mentally, the disease. The reason for the unbalance isn't even up for discussion. It just is. We're meeting people where they're at. They have strength. They're of all ages, all races, all background. And we have them at the emergency rooms. You'd think sometimes if you go in as a patient, it's a prison cell there. It's a free-for-all of what you see, of nurses, doctors. I have them calling me all the time, the security that's needed in various settings. And then you have the nursing homes, the assisted livings, group homes, apartments, various situations. So I understand what your ask is. I would just say, I hope in this session we're going to deal with making sure we pay people and deal with that issue, what we need to pay them, so we stop the revolving door and we can have enough staff. And the interventions are absolutely critical, like you're saying. And I support all that of, you know, timely interventions and having de-escalation. All those are great concepts. I worry, though, that we're putting a Band-Aid on a much bigger issue is my observation. And I want to make sure that the real meat and potato is dealt with this session, because without it, the people are going to be in harm's way, and we aren't going to change that and get out of the cycle. So commend you for being in the field, We're in challenging times, and the type of people we are caring for at every level in the health service thing, whether it's public health home visits, correction officers, police, emergency rooms, or centers, it is challenging times. And you're right, 80% of the day is great, but you have 20% of unpredictable behaviors. So thank you for your comments, and that's my only comment for today. Thank you.
Representative Hill.
Thank you, Chair, and thank you so much, Rep. Frederick, for your service at St. Peter. I've spent many, many hours at that facility in all different buildings, and in visiting with staff. A couple weeks ago, I just took a little time talking to probably one of your coworkers that's been there for 15 plus years. And again, I want to echo just pay and how you're losing staff too, because it's a grueling job. And when you talk about the level of intensity and being in certain environments, having to be very watchful is huge. And so, and I thank you for caring for people that have found themselves in really horrible situations that are there trying to be rehabilitated. So I'm a little concerned, really quick. I was looking at some of the language from like 3.16, you know, down to 3.19. Just talking about safety equipment that must not include tools or devices that facilitate physical or chemical restraint, barriers, except plexiglass barriers in office settings, you know, things like that. So I'm just curious, why are some of these things that would seem like a necessary advantageous tool to be used, like why are they excluded?
That's kind of my question. Thank you, Mr. Chair. I would say that there was a lot of conversations in landing in the final language that we got to. And this bill does not say that the things that are here are banned at a statewide level, that the, just the grant money that this is being used to can't be used for those specific things. So I just want to make that, like, I want to make that clarification, if that makes sense. And so this just says the grant money that if an agency is applying for this grant money, it can't be used for that. It's not saying that they're banned from that stuff in general terms, if that makes sense. But I know that there's been a lot of conversations with stakeholders in trying to get as many people to be supportive of this legislation as possible. And with 8 rounds of feedback by the time we finally got to this language to land here. It was kind of the consensus language. But I would say that another Michelle would be good for answering that as well.
Ms. Sackett.
Yeah, thank you, Chair Noor, and Representative Gilman. So another reason, or just another reason why we added that language, is that in some cases things like seclusion or barriers can escalate a situation, so it can actually make it worse, especially in some community-based settings. And, you know, we want to be doing as many preventative measures as possible, like certain sorts of training that can focus on crisis prevention and de-escalation in the moment rather than things that might amp up the level of crisis in a situation too.
So just one follow-up. The other thing that was just, you know, a little concerning is just, again, it's hard from my understanding, is how do you rank or, you know, provide grant opportunities for people? And it's more you came to the consensus of first come, first serve. Would you be willing to, like, meet offline to figure out, like, different parameters or where it's worked in other states, other, you know, other places where they've found very challenging situations? What have they done? Have you looked into other states or other grants or other places that we've done things to help support staff there? Again, when you talk about competitive wages and why there is burnout happening, you know, things like that, and how we can look at the full big picture versus just one part of it. Just kind of.
Representative Frederick.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Representative Gilman. I'm happy to have any conversation about this at all. I did not address this, but both you and Representative Zalesnikar also had mentioned wages. I do not think that this is a one-stop shop solution for the workforce in the slightest. I think this is to the pieces of talking about the workforce shortages across all of the different human services fields, I think wages are a huge part of that. And I think that, you know, I'm sure that this committee, I know the policy committee, has heard that over and over. And so this is a case of we need to do all of that. I'm fully supportive of all of that. But this is something that I believe that we need to address in addition to. It's a yes and kind of situation that we need to do all of that while at the same time talking about the safety aspects as well. One of the things that while it is kind of first come first serve basis, one of the efforts that I put into to try to put in some of that geographic equity as much as I can, saying that the grant money also can't be just concentrated in one region of the state or the other, that it has to be spread out throughout the state. But when it comes to trying to determine who needs it more than another person, when you have, I mean, you think of like a graph, right? You have severity and frequency. If you have a lot of high frequency but low severity, or if you have low frequency but high severity, like where on that line do you pick first of who to grant the program or grant the money to? Nobody that I talked to had a good answer for that. So if you have ideas, I'd be more than happy to talk with you ad nauseum about it. Yes. Sorry. Short answer. Yes. Happy to talk.
Thank you. Thanks so much.
Any further discussions? Representative Ford.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And looking at this, because of the shortage issues, some of the prohibited uses would be things that might be able to assist with a shorter staffed being able to do some of the activities. But I do notice there's a lot that's aimed at training and things which, when you have huge turnover, you're going to have to keep redoing. So I would think that a major component would be improving retention, because new people, there's a learning curve with the specific people you're interacting with. So someone that's been there for a while will catch something earlier and prevent a possible bad occurrence, or recognize something quickly enough to react to prevent a greater issue. I like the intent. I'm just thinking that if you don't couple it with retention, most of this is going to be spent and then dissipated because of the churn and the low staffing. So I think there needs to be some additional tweaking to maybe allow grants for things that augment or multiply the staffing efficiency and effectiveness. And then, you know, it has to be coupled with something that really helps keep people in a difficult situation, which means, you know, retention bonuses and other programs that might work there. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I agree with you, Representative Quam, that there is a high rate of turnover in a lot of these fields, and that the fear if that we're investing this money into a training and that there's just turning. But then you have to ask, why are some people leaving? Why are people, like, turning over to a different job? Are wages a piece of that? Absolutely. But is workplace safety also a piece of it? Yes. So I would argue that this bill, while it may not be perfect, does addressing some of those, the training piece. Like, if we can invest in training, like that's the piece that we want to focus on, that gives people more tools to avoid some of those hazardous situations, it could in theory help with retention. I know from and you had mentioned like retention bonuses and things like that. I know from my workplace that hasn't necessarily had a huge impact on retention, but I'm up for trying as well. So this is an attempt to try to help with the workforce crisis with safety in the workplace, I will never claim it is the end-all, be-all fix, because it's not.
Seeing no further discussion, your closing remarks, Representative Perry.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and committee. Again, I'm just going to say it again. The overwhelming majority of people in Minnesota who are getting some sort of help in the human services fields are wonderful people. They are not a threat. They are not violent. But this bill just wants to say, we see you who are working in those places where it does happen. And so I just felt it's important to say it again because I do not want to stigmatize anyone. I don't want to shame anyone. But we are in an unprecedented workforce crisis, and safety needs to be addressed as much as we are capable of. And so I would appreciate the committee's support. Thank you.
Thank you so much. I'll renew my motion that House File 1494 be laid over for possible inclusion. The bill is laid over. Thank you so much, Representative Frederick. The next two bills, Representative Hicks. The first one is House File 1043. Please move the bill, and I see you also have a two amendments.
Hello, Chair and committee members. Yes, I do have an amendment to move today.
Representative Hicks moves the House File 1043 to be laid over for possible inclusion, and she also moves a two amendment to put the bill in the shed to author one. All those in favor, please say aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed? The motion prevails, and please present your bill as amended.
Thank you so much, Chair and members. I would note that the amendment did remove the pilot projects from this bill, and I wanted to note that because I do, we have asked our nonpartisan staff about what that means for a fiscal impact, so I just wanted to share that. Many people who have disabilities use disability services, and they find the process to access them virtually very, very difficult and extremely frustrating. This includes individuals who utilize services, parents, caregivers, who are trying to support individuals accessing these services. Although disability services are aimed and designed to support people's disability-related needs, the process of receiving and maintaining those services presents a variety of barriers. Because of disability-related needs, people struggle to even access the services that they so desperately need. There's difficulties with completing complex and confusing paperwork. Outdated or very specific methods of getting information to places, such as faxing. Communicating with different individuals at lead agencies or state agencies, often prescribed to occur in very specific ways without flexibility. Participating in assessments, which, if you've ever been through a MnChoices assessment, is a challenging assessment, both in length, complexity, and in information needing to be shared. Resolving disputes if there's concerns about service determination, understanding their appeal rights, ensuring they received their appeal rights, and understand how to utilize them if necessary. These barriers result sometimes in appeals, and sometimes they result in people just giving up. This bill brings together stakeholders who are invested and committed to ensuring that not only do the services work for people, but the process to access them is successful. The goal here is to examine the system in its entirety and make suggestions on how to create a system that works better for the people that use it, with their voices being centered at the process. With that, I will let my testifier speak.
Ms. Nelson, welcome to the committee. Please introduce yourself for the record and proceed.
Good afternoon, Chair Noor and committee members. I am Jillian Nelson from the Autism Society of Minnesota. I'm also an autistic adult and a participant in Ramsey County Disability Services. I will tell you, most days my work here on the Hill is, as a lobbyist, is simpler, more streamlined, and effortless when compared to the process of applying for and navigating disability services. Disability Services is the only program that 100% of participants are people with disabilities, and currently it is one of the least accessible programs Minnesota has to offer. House File 1034 can change that. It will bring together a valuable group of stakeholders and start unpacking the process to identify the barriers across the system so that we can make corrections for the entire system instead of just patching one micro problem at a time. I looked over the notes from last year's hearing, and I was reminded of a call that I received on the eve of that hearing. It was a colleague informing me that an autistic woman we knew was in ICU after trying to take her own life because navigating the system to get a waiver and supports was too much. And I think the most heartbreaking part was that I had already sent a letter to the committee from a mother who had lost her son to suicide for the same fight. This outcome happens far too often. For too long, the disability community has been the one to bear the burden of consequence for the lack of accessibility and administrative errors for how the state and county administers disability services. From a finance perspective, it is the state footing the bill for crisis caused by lack of support, excessive challenges created by inaccuracy, and countless hearings that should not be occurring. In less than 2 years of waiver support, I have had to file over 5 appeals and go in front of a judge. Every single one was overturned and unjustified. At one point, I went in front of a judge because a public health nurse documented my diagnosis incorrectly. All of this comes with a high dollar price tag, and that is money that is going towards inequity and inaccessibility instead of serving people with disabilities. Lack of accessibility in disability services should be considered fraud, waste, and abuse of disability funds. DHS believes that Waiver Reimagine and MnChoices 2.0 will help make the system more accessible for people. That is a demonstration of why this is necessary. When administrators think reform, it's about how to make the system work better for them. But what we need is to make the system easier for the people who navigate the services. The solution to these accessibility challenges before us is not going to be a simple answer, but the choice to include the community and the people with lived experiences is simple. We know the challenges this system presents. We know the challenges the world presents. We know what we want for our lives and the things we need to survive. We know what accessibility looks like and means to us. We should be a part of that solution, and that is what this task force aims to do. Thank you for your support of House File 1043.
Thank you so much for your testimony. Any other person in the public who wants to testify on this bill? Seeing none, member discussion? Representative Kim.
Thank you, Chair. Thank you, Representative Hicks. Task forces are really hard, and when we start adding more people, it gets really hard. I've done a couple task forces, and the fact that we're going from 24 members up to 28 is hard to manage. I struggle with the changes that you made on 210, that originally it said 2 representatives of county or tribal agencies, and now we've just added 1 tribal representation. I think we need to understand the sovereignty and who stands on this land, and that I always suggest that there should always be 2 options for tribal nations to be a part of this. And also my last question is, where is like your greater Minnesota voice on this task force? Because I know in other task forces that we've put together, there's requirements that some of these have to have a greater Minnesota or rural Minnesota voice at the table. You have a whole lot of agencies here. So I just kind of caution that though I understand what you're trying to do, the makeup of this doesn't feel overly equitable for Minnesota. Thank you.
Thank you so much for that feedback. I really appreciate it. The change was really made to try to get more people with disabilities included and to try to create equity. And if we miss the mark there, I would be happy to revisit that. That was the intention, was to make sure that that was included. And we maybe did miss the mark. We did add, you know, some folks that felt like they had been not included originally. So DHH, veterans with disabilities, and some other folks, and it is a large task force. Part of the problem with the size of the task force and kind of how we've struggled with sort of figuring out the right size is because people with disabilities exist everywhere. They exist in Greater Minnesota. They exist in veteran services. They exist with hearing deficits. They exist across all spectrums. Disability is the great equalizer.
and it affects everyone. And so, but the system isn't working for people with disabilities across the board. And so this was an attempt to make sure that we didn't leave out any voices, but I am completely open to changing some of that language to make that work.
Ms. Nelson.
Thank you, Chair Noor. I know it does seem like a very large task force. As someone who has served on task forces aimed at disability services, I actually think this is to our benefit, not to our detriment. People with disabilities have complicated lives. Task forces are a lot of work. I recently served on a task force where I was a co-chair and also a member of five different subgroups because that's where my perspective was needed. That's a lot. The more hands and heads and hearts we bring to the table, the easier we can divide up that work and not put such a huge burden on people with lived experience to turn a task force into a full-time job. The task force I was a part of, I'm not sure I thought of much else than that task force for a good chunk of last year. And that's not a privilege that every person with a disability has. And that's why bringing together a larger group really is beneficial for this community because we can work together instead of all the burden being on a small group of people.
Thank you, Chair Noor and Representative Hicks, and thank you for your testimony also. You know, my question kind of piggybacks on the concern Rep. Keeler's saying. I'm concerned about adding a task force at this moment in time when we have so many questions of, and I just have questions in my mind of the overlaps between public health and veterans programs and county caseworkers and tribal leaders, and then the Olmstead thing that's there. And so it just feels blurred to me. And I want to have systems be simplified, and I'm all for that. I would just urge maybe just a reset pause to think through some of these pieces. And maybe it's because I'm a first-term representative that I feel this way. But that's when I read this, that's the part that gives me angst of a bureaucratic piece that is, it sounds great, but in application could become very messy. And I've seen that happen before with task force, and I've been on them too. And I just, we have so many things right now at the state of Minnesota that are a deep dive that I'd hate to see something without a clear-cut piece when there's many avenues that are just like seniors and children and disabilities that are we have in place right now. And while they're not perfect, we have to peel the onion back to see which parts of them are doing X before we can create Y. And that's my concern. But I understand your intentions, and I appreciate it. I just have some concerns on how this is going to actually play out with the other pieces we have in place. And that's where I have hesitation. So I just urge that you look at those things and appreciate your intentions. Thanks.
Yes. So maybe I'm not clear about the purpose of the task force. So the task force is designed to do just that. It's designed to look at the system and figure out what's not working. So I'll give you an example. On Friday, I am meeting someone for lunch. This woman is a doctor. She's a MD in a specialty. And her child was recently diagnosed. She has spent the last 3 months trying to navigate this system. She can't. She's stuck. We are going to lunch so that I can walk her through the paperwork, so I can explain to her the process. The process for her child to get the things that he needs to grow, thrive, and get the supports and services he needs to live his best life include gathering all of his medical documentation, applying for a certification of disability. But because they're over income limits, because remember, she's a doctor, she can't apply through the feds, through Social Security, because they're over the income limits. So we have to do a SMRT, which is a state medical review team documentation. To do that, we have to fill out that application. We have to submit the medical records. Then we have to fill out the certain populations application for medical assistance for TEFRA. But we can't do that till we do the SMRT. So we're going to do all of that together, and we're going to drive it to the county and turn it in, because that's the system that our county uses. And then I have to teach her how to follow up on it. And in 9 months, she will have a determination about whether her child is disabled enough to qualify. And then once that determination occurs, then she has to fill out the parental fee paperwork and submit that to the county. The county then has to take that parental fee paperwork and send it up to the state. The state in the parental fee unit, which, by the way, has been understaffed for 5 years, has to calculate her parental fee. They will then reach back out to her and tell her what her parental fee. And then her and her husband have to decide if that $3,000 a month parental fee, if they can swing that to get the child the services that they need.
And that's if they don't have paperwork.
And that's if they get all the paperwork right. And so the point of the task force is to have groups of people who understand those complicated processes for all of the different people who are accessing services and say, what's not working about this process and for whom and how do we streamline it? Because it looks different if you're a child. It looks different if you need a waiver. It looks different if you have an adult with a disability. It's different if you're working. It's different if you're on Social Security. It is so confusing. The idea of the task force isn't to create more bureaucracy. The idea of the task force is to identify where the bureaucracy is broken so we can fix it. So I wanted to clarify the focus of the group, because I'm not sure that I got that across the first time. So I do apologize for not kind of communicating that effectively.
I think, Representative Hicks, you lost everyone in the room when you started talking about TEFRA and the smart review process and the parental fee. It's complicated. Yeah. Representative Zelesnicka.
Chair Noor, I'll be fast. And Representative Hicks, and thank you. I understand how complicated this is, but we have systems in place. It goes back to workforce at the counties. It goes back. I believe in local support and having the county social workers, public health. They know the community. And another task force is going to create complication in my mind. When I look at this, I look at, we had knowledge for years on things. I've worked with counties to get people on medical assistance for seniors. The same type of thing. When knowledge isn't passed on, with it, whether it's DHS, MDH, MDE, systems are there. We have professionals in every entity that we are funding right now. But if we don't have systems to transfer knowledge to before retirements and plan, and then look at how we're funding the existing programs we have, that's my piece that I want to see strengthened and then looked at, because these systems have been in place for a while. Whether or not the dots aren't being connected, I believe there's a way that it could be done. I'm just offering another alternative, that there's opportunities for it to be done without creating this at this point in time. And that's just my position.
Thank you so much for that. And I appreciate that. And then I would just say, you know, part of the reason that the system is so not working for people with disabilities is because they're not included in the process and identifying what's working or not. In the entire statement that you just eloquently shared, they weren't mentioned. And they're never mentioned when we're designing the things. They're not mentioned when we're crafting how we're going to do it. They aren't spoken to or included in the process of development. And so then when we get to implementation and it doesn't work for them, we all go, well, I mean, it's fine. It's not fine. That is why we are in the mess we're in, is because they haven't been included. And so this task force doesn't aim to change communication or change any of that. It really just aims to take a step back, put the people who are accessing services, including people with disabilities and parents, at the center of the conversation so that they can look at the system with the people who create the system and talk about what the barriers are. So when we make it better, we're making it better from their lens, not from the lens of the people entering the stuff in the computer. And that is so important, because if the end user can't do it, can't access it, and by the end user here I mean the person needing services, then what's the point of the system?
Would that hearing no further discussion, please proceed with the closing remarks and renew your motion.
I will just renew my motion. I think I've said more than I probably needed to.
Representative Hicks renews her motion that House File 1043 as amended to be laid over for possible inclusion. The bill is laid over. The next bill is 1851. I will move House File 1851 to be laid over for possible inclusion. Please proceed, Representative Hicks, with your bill.
Thank you so much, Chair and members. This is the Live Well at Home bill. Very, very excited about this bill today. I do have an amendment that I'd also like to include.
Representative Hicks has the DE1 amendment.
And the purpose of this bill is really just to get it into the shape that it needs to be.
Representative Clark.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Analyzing the DE amendment in the original, I'm seeing an extremely little difference. So can you tell us exactly what differences are between the DE and the original bill?
Yes, thank you. Thank you, Representative Palm, for the question. I am looking at my notes to make sure that I don't forget anything. Oh, that would be helpful. Thank you.
Mr. Chair, members, this DE amendment was already put on at the last committee stop. The version of the bill you're looking at is the first engrossment with the DE already put in.
That's why I was confused. That's helpful.
Sorry about that.
I have had like a lot of bills this week.
Mr. Chair, the only difference I saw was the notation to amend the title accordingly in content.
Taken by the non-partisan.
Okay, so this is a procedural thing. All right.
Yep.
Thank you.
So that's just more procedural. We can go further with there is no amendment, members, so we'll go back to the first motion, House to move that House File 1851 to be laid off of possible inclusion. I know I got scared of my CA, so he ran out. So go ahead with your testimony.
Thank you so much, everyone. I have collaborated with Family Services Rochester, AARP, and the Minnesota Chapter of Alzheimer's Association to revitalize the Live Well at Home grant program by bringing much-needed updates and increasing funding for the first time in years. The Live Well at Home grant program is a proven resource to help seniors living where they want to be, in the community with the people they love. Seniors want to live in the community, and many cannot do this without help. The flexibility of the grant funding distributed through the Live Well at Home grant program funds the services seniors need, including volunteer respite programs across the state and tribal nations. This is good for our seniors, their families, and communities, and the state of Minnesota. Minnesota's family caregivers are the backbone of our long-term care system and play an essential role in caring for their loved ones and delaying expensive nursing home level of care. The Live Well at Home grants support them as well. House File 1851 brings some much needed updates to the Live Well at Home grant program and necessary infusion of new resources at a time of great need. If we want to support seniors living in the community, we need to take action now to invest in the programs that work. I will also add that the Live Well at Home grants fill in some of the holes for seniors that maybe don't qualify for some of our more intensive programs, which is also a really wonderful cost savings for the state of Minnesota, and also a really good way to make sure that we're meeting people where they're at. So I will turn it over to my testifier.
Welcome to the committee. Please introduce yourself for the record.
Assalamu alaikum, Honorable Chair and members. I'm April Souter with Family Service Rochester. We provide home and community-based services that help older adults remain in their homes in Rice and Olmsted counties. Family Service Rochester has been fortunate to receive Live Well at Home grants for a number of years, and the bill before you today provides for ongoing, stable, foundational funding that helps nonprofits like ours provide low-cost elder services. In 2022, more than 800 volunteers in Rice and Olmsted counties gave 44,942 hours of service that enabled 988 seniors to age in place. That's the equivalent of 21.6 full-time staff. Seniors don't go away, and their needs don't stop just because funding does. with no services, seniors have little choice but to move to residential facilities where their resources are quickly depleted. Then they turn to government for support. Providing services that help older adults age in place saves government and, in turn, taxpayer money. Stable, renewable funding for nonprofit organizations who deliver on outcomes is what we need and what we seek through this legislation. Doing so builds statewide capacity and stability for home and community-based elder service providers and family caregivers. Thank you for your service to Minnesota and your support for House File 1851.
Thank you so much for your testimony. The next person is Stacy. Welcome to the committee. Please introduce yourself for the record and proceed.
Hello. My name is Stacy Hammer, and I'm an enrolled member of the Lower Sioux Indian Community. We're one of four Dakota communities here in the state of Minnesota. I'm also the Director of Community Health for the Lower Sioux. And on behalf of our community, I would like to provide testimony to support for the Live Well at Home Bill, House File 1851. I feel very strongly and agree with the proposal set forth in this bill based on my lived experience in administering this program to our Shawn Shiapi elders for the last couple of years. Our Live Well at Home program is named the Shawn Shiapi Kaw program. Shawn Shiapi is the traditional name for our community, and Kaw is the Dakota word for elders. The goal of our program has been to seek to reinstate the role of elders within our tribe as a strategy to transfer knowledge and promote healing and well-being for our elders and for the community. The continued goal of our Live Well at Home project is to nurture the well-being of Lower Sioux elders through expanded social, physical, and intergenerational cultural strategies that lead to improved health, increased capacity to live at home, in a strong age-friendly community. We have been able to build a program for our elders to meet their needs through a variety of strategies that are tied to Dakota culture while consistently receiving input from our elders on ways to improve the program. The main challenge we are faced with under the current statute is the length of the short grant cycle. As the director, I administer several grant programs with nonprofit, state, and federal grant funding partners. The Live Well at Home grant is the only grant program that we are required to apply for on an annual basis. We are also not guaranteed to be funded, or in other words, the annual application is not a continuation grant, but rather writing a completely new, lengthy proposal every year. Further, our community does not have a large grant writing team that we can lean on to assist with grant writing. Therefore, I am the sole participant in the grant writing of the Live Well at Home application, along with other grant community health grants. The amount of time it takes every March to write this proposal and gather all the required documents is daunting, to say the least. We are also required as grantees to provide quarterly reports to the Minnesota Department of Human Services, as well as video check-ins with DHS staff. While I completely understand and support the reasoning behind these written reports and the check-in meetings with DHS personnel, the added time to write a new proposal every year makes this incredibly challenging and a huge barrier to our work. I love my work, and I'm having the privilege to work for my community and especially for my elders. I truly appreciate the opportunity to partner with the Minnesota Department of Human Services and the Live Well at Home program. I have seen firsthand how important and vital this program has been for our elders. However, I would like to reiterate again how strongly I support Live Well at Home Bill, House File 1851. This will help to sustain this program with longer-term funding and provide a more equitable framework for our community, as well as other communities seeking this funding opportunity. Padamaye, thank you.
Thank you so much for your testimony. Do we have anyone else in the public who wants to testify on this bill? Seeing none, member discussion. Representative Gilmore.
Thank you, Chair. So, quick question, and maybe this is for nonpartisan staff too, just to kind of go over the fiscal note would be great, since that wasn't in our.
I think the amount is already in the bill. It's $15 million.
What? I didn't see that.
Yeah, 15 and 15.
It's on page 6. You'll see the appropriation section.
So it's not higher than $30 million?
So it's every fiscal year, $15 million. So that makes it by any $30 million. I will let Mr. Burt just go through the appropriation section.
Mr. Chair and representatives, that's correct. It's there's a direct appropriation in the bill, and so that is the cost. I have not I think I have this one in there, is likely some modest administrative costs as well. We don't have a completed fiscal note on this, but the bulk of the money is the $30 million.
Mr. Beck, what's the base for this funding?
I do, Mr. Chair, I do not know that off the top of my head. I emailed the department with that question several months ago, and I don't remember offhand what the answer was. Maybe Ms. Bailey knows.
Ms. Bailey, I know she's, the Director Bailey is coming down. Welcome to the committee. Please introduce yourself for the record and proceed.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. For the record, Elise Bailey, Budget Director, and I have to admit I didn't hear the question.
The base for the Live at Wealth program, this program.
I can gather that for you. I don't have it off the top of my head.
We'll follow up, and I think the appropriation requested here is $30 million, as indicated in the bill.
Mr. Chair?
Mr. Burke.
Mr. Chair, I look at my report on fiscal notes that I've done, and I realize that I actually have a completed fiscal note, which should have gone out to the members here. Yeah. I will make sure it gets distributed to the members right after this hearing.
Should be online, too. So
yeah.
It's on the,
but we'll send it around. It should have been in your packets.
Can I just ask really quick, so when you're looking at that fiscal note, can you give me the dollar amount? That's what I was wondering.
I don't.
So with the additional cost is 31,474. And then in the tails is 31,526.
So you're talking 63-ish, 62, $63 million total.
No,
in the biennium?
For biennium is 31,474. And then in 26, 27 is 31,526. With the additional cost of running the program.
Okay. Yeah, that's helpful to understand the enormity of it. Thank you.
Thank you so much, Director Bailey.
Mr. Chair, the base for the program is $2 million in a biennium.
Thank you for that update. I know we got all the answers that we were looking for, so it's when we get to get the answers immediately. Thank you so much, Director Bailey. Representative Singer.
Thank you, Chair Noor, and thank you, Representative Hicks. I just have a quick question on, for the fiscal note, if this is to move forward, is there, can you explain to me the process and how it's distributed across the counties?
Representative. I will call back DHS to answer how, or some, I'm phoning a friend, whoever wants to answer the distribution, how the distribution occurs of the grant program.
See, Ms. Stockett's coming down. Please introduce yourself for the record and proceed.
Hi, everyone. Good afternoon. Nicole Stockert with the Department of Human Services. Would you mind repeating the question? Is it about grants?
Distribution. How the funds are distributed under this program.
It is it's a current, thank you for the question, so, Chair and Representative. So the current way that these are distributed is through a competitive process right now through an RFP. And so it's done through a grant mechanism that the Department of Human Services administers through, like I say, a competitive grant process.
Representative Zelensky.
Thank you, Chair Noor, and thank you. I'm wondering when you say competitive grant process for an RFP, I don't know what that looks like. Is that competitive meaning, if all things are equal, Greater Minnesota is going to have it's an unequal percentage of these grants?
Ms. Sock.
Chair Noor and Representative, I probably would be best to follow up with you with the people that administer this program about, you know, the different types of things that they look at. But I can tell you that the original program right now is meant to be a seed program. And so they're looking at sort of expanding services, new services. And so that's sort of like the current basis of this program, right? And so it sort of has this like 5-year sort of cap. Unless you come back and you want to provide a different service, you want to expand into a different area. What this amendment or what this change does, it says once you sort of graduate this, you know, original program, you have the ability then to access sort of this sustainable funding to kind of keep the lights on operations going so that we can keep these services available for the, you know, the services that are working well, if that makes sense.
Thank you, Chair, and thank you. You know, my question is just, I know in some of the rural areas, the limitations is just the number of people they have to process and do these. So I just want to make sure that we're looking at the, you know, the resources that are available in rural and greater Minnesota may not match the numbers and the resources, everything, with all things considered equal. And I think the need is very high. And so I want to make sure that, you know, what, however millions we're giving out, that greater Minnesota has its fair share, because it absolutely needs to. And the programs have been there living at home for years. But whether or not they're doing anything new or innovative, some of the base programs, I just want to make sure that greater Minnesota is not lost in this, that the tribal nations and greater Minnesota are part of this, and that we are able to serve the people statewide.
I got lots of friends, so I'm just going to let people talk.
Thank you for that question. So part of the impetus for the generation of this bill is that in southeast Minnesota there were programs in La Crescent and Chatfield and Albert Lea who lost funding, and they were small. They were very successful, but they lost a LiveWell grant, and they had to close their doors because they didn't have a foundation of funding upon which to build, so they went back to zero. This is asking to create that foundation so that, in particular, smaller communities and organizations who have been successful don't have to close their doors because they miss a grant. And that's the crux of being able to keep people living at home, is they have some continued and dependable services. So the rural areas in particular.
Thank you, Chair, and thank you. I have no further questions. I just wanted to have that acknowledged and confirmed, so thank you.
For your closing statement, Representative.
Thank you so much, Chair, and thank you so much, members. This program makes sense for communities, it makes sense for our seniors, and it makes sense for Minnesota. So I hope that we have the opportunity to expand the program and allow more communities to participate. Thank you.
Well, Representative, I renew my motion that House File 1851 to be laid over for possible inclusion. The bill is laid over. So, members, that was the last bill. We'll have another hearing tomorrow. We are now adjourned.